Welcome in to the OMR Podcast International. My name is Scott Peterson, Digital Marketing Editor at OMR. We are back. I'm back in the proverbial saddle again on the mic as your host. And I have to say, we have quite the show for you today. Phil Libben joins me on the pod, founder and CEO of and ex-CEO of note-taking and productivity app Evernote. Phil is a lot of things. In addition to being a serial entrepreneur, he's a regular on the speaking circuit, from podcasts and webinars to appearances on CNBC. He's a champion of remote work and an all-around intelligent guy. On top of his past endeavors at Evernote and others, we spoke about his current project, Launched as an inside joke right after the pandemic started, is an app that makes video presenting a lot more enjoyable. But I'm not the only one who thinks that. Just 5 months after launch, had a round of Series A funding worth round about $41 million U.S. Not bad at all. But before we get to Phil, a quick heads up. Don't worry if at some point during the conversation you start hearing a freight train rolling past in the background. You are not hallucinating. Phil called in from his place in Arkansas, which is apparently close to some train tracks. Now, I know my producer Florian is going to get as much of it out as possible, so hopefully it doesn't distract too terribly much from my conversation with Phil. All right, that's it from me. Enjoy the pod. Buzz. Yeah, so I'm thrilled to have joining me on the other line from halfway around the world. I was going to say from the West Coast of the United States, but it's not entirely true. But it's CEO and founder of Phil Libben. Phil, how are you? Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
There's a lot that I'm looking forward to talking to you about. I'll be doing a fair amount of jumping around, talking about what you're doing now, what you've been up to. But I think it's only logical we start with your current endeavor, which is What can you tell the people about I know elevator pitches are a no-go for you. So take all the time you need.
Well, it's something we started working on really as a joke back in May, a couple of months after the pandemic started. And, you know, we all had to go on lockdown and, video was just really boring. I kind of noticed, you know, the first few weeks of the lockdown, I think, wasn't boring because it was kind of scary. So we were all just, you know, terrified about what was going to happen. But then, yeah, a couple of months into it, the kind of the sheer panic had subsided, but it was replaced with just tedium. Like all of our meetings were lame and presentations were ineffective. So we just started goofing around on video, trying to duplicate some of the styles that we'd seen on, you know, comedy shows and news shows, and just try to make our video lives a little bit more interesting. And it took off from there.
Okay, so you started tinkering with the idea in May, and then this past October you raised about $21 million in Series A funding, if I'm not mistaken. It's a pretty good start.
$36 million, I think.
36. Okay. Yeah. Even better.
I think, yeah, between the seed and the A round. Yeah,
okay.
36.
And how big is the company now? How many employees?
Well, we're about 45 people on the team. Okay. And we started out with two. So it's gone pretty fast in less than a year. But this is part of, we spun out of All Turtles. All Turtles was our product studio that we try to make, you know, worthwhile products with as little, you know, nonsense and inefficiency as possible. And so I think we were able to get up to speed so quickly because there was already a bunch of people at All Turtles that we could put to work on this thing. So the first, you know, 20 or so people that worked on were all All Turtles employees. And then we went out and hired a bunch of new people. So it was a good way to get a jump start on what we were doing.
Okay. And so give me a few of the greatest hits at first. You said it started as a joke. So you just popped up unannounced at a couple of Zoom meetings, had some nifty backgrounds rocking. I imagine that resonated pretty well with your people, otherwise you wouldn't have pursued it.
Yeah, I mean, I actually, like, there's some tweets when I just started, like, experimenting before we had actually written any code. I just started goofing around on Zoom. I had a green camping towel. I don't know why I have a camping towel because I've never been camping, but I like buying camping equipment. I think that's what I'm into. So I had this green towel that I hung up behind me, and it's just kind of a small towel, but I started projecting images onto it just in Zoom, kind of pretending that it was like a monitor or a screen.
And then, your green screen.
Yeah, I started having, you know, Anthony Fauci standing behind me, you know, nodding very, very disapprovingly and that kind of stuff. And yeah, people just, you know, it was like, it was the first time that I'd seen people smile in a while. I mean, okay. You got to remember the first couple of months of the pandemic, like these are not happy times. And then we made something just because I wanted to show off my Instagram photos. I have a lot of like wacky Instagram pictures from Japan. So I was just, you know, showing those off in meetings. And then the kind of light bulb moment came when I thought, oh, let me try giving a presentation this way. I think I was teaching some class. Yeah, I was teaching a class and I had to do it online. And I thought, man, this is just going to be boring because normally, you know, I use slides. And when you do slides online, you have to like, oh, I'm going to share my screen. And then like the slides are in one box and you're in a different box and people are splitting their attention. And it's hard to do any of the – it's just hard to be charismatic that way.
Sure.
And so I tried making the slides so that I could just project them behind me, sort of, you know, news anchor style. Mm-hmm. And that worked really well. I taught this class and I just got this great, you know, feedback about it. And a lot of people like wanted to know how I was doing that and wanted to do it themselves. And so then I thought, yeah, maybe this is a thing. So we quickly put together like a rough tech, you know, prototype. And then I just showed it to some investor friends of mine, just as like, hey, we built this thing. We're not sure if we're going to do anything with it. What do you think? And every single person we showed it to wanted to, you know, either buy it or invest in it. So within a few weeks, we thought, all right, yeah, this should be real. Something. Let's take it seriously.
And how many users do you have now? I know that you just entered Windows beta, correct, at the end of the first of the month?
Yeah, we just, so we went out of beta on the Mac in November. So we've been publicly launched just on the Mac for a few months now, 4 months or whatever it's been. And then we just went into open beta on Windows a couple of weeks ago. You know, we decided, so I made a decision when I was at Evernote. We were like extremely transparent about numbers. We would just give numbers out all the time. And I vowed I would never do that again because it's a trap. It's like Admiral Akbar says, and, you know, Empire Strikes Back. It's a trap because once you do it, you just got to keep doing it. And like, and it doesn't matter if the numbers are good or bad. It's just like endless. So we basically said, we're not giving out numbers. We're just sticking with it. There's a lot of video. In fact, the first class I taught using was this, the state machine. If you just Google my name and state machine.
Sure, I actually wanted to get to that a little bit later, but yeah. Yeah,
so I think that was like the first one that I actually did. And there's probably video of it somewhere because it was for like one of these, I think it was for Founder Institute or something.
And, yeah, I think that sounds correct, yeah.
So we're very intentional about what we measure and what's important. And at the early stage of a product, which is where we're at now, what's not important is the total number of users. What is important is that the people that are using it are getting a lot of value out of it. So it's measuring the product market fit and how quickly is that growing. And we have a pretty elaborate like setup for how do we measure that, which I talk about in the state machine thing. So like that's what we keep track of, and I'm thrilled with the results. And once we're pretty confident that we've got, you know, solid product market fit, then we start worrying about, okay, well, how quickly is the overall user base growing and we'll
scaling it up and that type of thing. Okay. But yeah, so we're dealing with a very, very young startup. So it's probably way too early. Well, you're smiling. Maybe that's incorrect because you're a very experienced individual. You've got all turtles behind you. But within a year to have raised this amount of capital and to have this much positive resonation, I think most entrepreneurs would only dream of that type of performance. But what I was wanting to get at is probably too early to talk about monetizing. At least I thought it would be. But I did see at the beginning of April, you guys released a couple of pricing plans. What goes into that decision? Is that like, how do you reach the conclusion that, okay, now we're ready to start charging for this product?
Yeah, we were actually charging for it from the first day when we launched, when we went out of beta on the Mac. So we have this core philosophy going all the way back to Evernote. A lot of the team here was the original team at Evernote, which is direct revenue only. So we the product is the product. I mean, you know, people, you'll often hear people saying like, well, like if you're not sure how like the tech companies make money, then like you're the product. And like we reject that. So you're not the product. Our product is the product. We only make money when people or companies choose to pay us because they want to use the product. So it's like a very old fashioned, you know, business model. And to get that to work, we need to like we need to start charging for it, you know, from day one. So it's a freemium model, just like, you know, just like at Evernote and a bunch of other stuff we've done. So you can use it for free. Everyone can use it for free for a limited period of time. And then after that, you can keep using it for free, but at a reduced function set, or you buy a subscription. Mm-hmm. That's what it's been from day one. I mean, that's the business model. What we launched on April 1st, which we decided was going to be from now on, we're going to call that April Truth Day because April Fool's Day gags. So on April 1st, we launched the enterprise version. So now companies can buy it. So it's called business, and you can you basically buy it for all of your employees, because I think a lot of companies are realizing that video is here to stay in an important way, and it's important for companies that everyone be effective on video and on brand. So that's how we make money. We're freemium on the consumer side. We charge companies. And that's been going great. I think there's a significant amount of willingness to pay for good products that make video suck less.
Sure. So it's definitely born of COVID. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem like you feel like you're under any type of pressure to kind of get while the getting's good, so to speak, and capitalize on the moment of people working from home. I mean, I think it's fair to say that most companies are going to have some amount of remote working in place moving forward from here. But is there any pressure to get it out there and get the word out while the awareness is perhaps at its peak, or the willingness to accept video?
So I think this is a permanent, change in the world. The hype cycle is going to, it's going to crest and fall and, crest again, like the hype cycle always does. But that's not important. One of the reasons why we wanted to raise a significant amount of money is because we want to remove ourselves from the hype cycle. We don't want to be like surfing, oh, this month everyone thinks video is hot. Oh, this month people are going back to the office and they think that video is over. Like that's nonsense. The long term, the macro trend, the secular trend in the world is, over the past year, we were all on video because we had to be. Mm-hmm. Now, as the pandemic is hopefully ending, we get out of it, we're going to keep being on video for the things that are better on video. So a lot of the stuff that we as an industry have invented over the past year actually turns out is really good. It's an effective way to do things. And so those things that are better done in a distributed way on video are going to continue to be done in video. And those things that are better done in person are going to be done in person. Video, like video's transformation of the world is, it's just getting started. And yeah, maybe like 3 months from now, it will be less hype than 3 months ago. But I have 100% confidence that a year from now, 2 years from now, it's actually going to be much bigger than it's ever been, because like the real work is just getting started.
Sure. So who would you say is your core target group with Who are you aiming it at, or who are the primary users?
Well, it's people for whom being better on video makes an important impact in their lives. So it's basically professionals that need to do stuff on video, which is almost all of them, and education. So we have a lot of teachers, a lot of students, and a lot of investors, journalists, salespeople. It's a pretty broad range of use cases. Sure. We have. There's a group, we publish like stories just about, people using it on our blog fairly frequently. And there's some really great ones. I mean, we have large public companies using it for, board meetings and like investor calls and, road shows. And we have literally a group of hospital clowns, people whose businesses, they're clowns. They go to hospitals to like entertain sick children. And, they use it because it's just a very effective way to do it. So I think when you have like actual clowns and Fortune 500 CEOs, like that's a pretty good spectrum of uses.
It's fairly broad, but doesn't that also create maybe some difficulties in the approach to the product itself? Those are such divergent polar opposites, CEOs and clowns. I mean, parse that as much as you want, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think it influences how we think about sales and marketing. Mm-hmm. It means that we need to try to make a product that's pretty broad, that has broad appeal, and that's simple enough to use, where you shouldn't need, down the road, you shouldn't need like a very complicated sales process or an installation process. And so it puts that kind of pressure on us. It puts pressure to just make something that's relatively simple, that's elegant, that appeals to a lot of people. And you know, but that's what the team's done before several times, relatively successfully. So we're comfortable with that. It's a different approach than say, you know, building traditional vertical enterprise SaaS software that's targeted for an industry where you try to get really deep expertise on how to sell to that industry. But that's never been something that we've been particularly good at anyway. So like we're good at making something that hundreds of millions of people love and want to use. Most of those people happen to be professionals or or in education. So we're just gonna do that again.
All right. I want to talk about the name. Mm-hmm. It's kind of it's a bit jarring, which is a good thing. Makes it very difficult to forget. I think already since we've started recording, I've said mm-hmm at least 50 times. Yeah. But I can imagine that an onomatopoetic name like that could make it difficult to find, unless there's some type of universal consensus I'm unaware of on how to spell it. But it is a palindrome that helps. Where did the name come from?
I mean, just like everything else, it just started out as a joke. We have a whole process for how to name things at Old Turtles. You know, we name lots of stuff because we work with a lot of startups, a lot of projects, and we have a whole framework for how to pick names, and broke all of the rules of our framework.
What type of framework? I'm very interested in that. I come from like a translation and a copywriting background, and I know like claims and finding names for things, one of the most tedious tasks possible, or can be, bang your head against the wall hours on end and no breakthroughs.
There's the bigger philosophy, which we very much did adhere to for the name and for everything else, which is, works for naming, works on any kind of design, which is we are trying to pick the thing that's the most good, mm-hmm. not the thing that's the least bad, which seems like a trivial statement, but it's important. There are decisions in life and at work where it's very important, critically important, to pick the least bad option.
The highest floor.
But there's other decisions in life where it actually doesn't matter if you get it wrong very much. So it's much more important to pick the most good option, the option that has the most good. Very often, the option that has the most good is also the one that has the most bad. Right. So mm-hmm. you can have a name or a design that is amazing and terrible at the same time. In fact, frequently, the thing that's the most amazing also has all sorts of flaws.
Sure.
And so the question is, like, is this a thing where you're trying to minimize the flaws? Or is this a thing where you're trying to maximize the positives, the amazing aspects? And you can never compare like the positives to the negatives. The human brain just doesn't work that way. If you think you're comparing like upside to downside, your amygdala takes over, your lizard brain, which is like mm-hmm. much more geared towards risk reduction for just about everyone. And so you make a very conservative decision. So the core philosophy for designing of startup things, where it doesn't matter if you fail. Like if your startup fails, if our startup fails, like so what? From the perspective of the world, obviously, mm-hmm. like it sucks for me, but I'll get over it. But in terms of for the world, like it's not it hasn't lost anything, right? It never had this thing to begin with, so it's okay to fail. And once you kind of realize that, like okay, we're not trying to be safe because we're not trying to protect anything because we have nothing to protect. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to be as good as possible, as amazing as possible, then you start making decisions that are all about maximizing the upsides. So when that comes to naming, it's like, well, okay, mm-hmm, all right, well, people aren't going to know how to spell it. Okay, yeah, that's a downside, all right. But I don't care about the downsides. Like we've decided that for this kind of thing, the downsides aren't what's important. What's important are the upsides, and the upsides are you'll remember it forever. It sticks in your head.
Sure.
It's funny. We like the name. It just makes us smile, to say it. And like those upsides are more important. And then it turns out, if you lean into it, a lot of the times the downsides just kind of go away. Because like you would think it's hard to find, but like it isn't. Go ahead and Google for mm-hmm, however you think it's spelled. Like you'll find us. It's okay. Like maybe it'll take you two clicks instead of one. But, it's the downsides are like
fair enough.
Actual downsides.
Yeah, fair enough. But you said mm-hmm broke all the rules. Can you elaborate on that for a second? How?
The naming rules?
Yeah.
So there's a process. So the closest published thing to how we think about naming officially is it's called the Igor Naming Guide. Mm-hmm. You can just Google Igor Naming Guide. Igor is we're not affiliated with Igor's a company. It's a naming company. And they published this, they published a framework called the Igor Naming Guide. And it's really good. So everyone who cares about naming should read it. We don't adhere to it strictly, but it's really important. I make everyone read it before we start talking about names, because like just the vocabulary is important. It's important for people to realize that like naming is a process. It's not a thing that like pops into your head in the shower and you're like, let's go with this. It's a process. There's different types of names. There's a whole taxonomy. There's examples of good and bad names in every taxonomy. You have to think about what you're trying to optimize for. And so the Igor naming guide is kind of a brilliant process for doing it. And we have a modified version of it that we've been using for, you know, more than a decade, just internally in all of our projects. You know, the first rule of that is like naming is a process. It isn't a thing that just pops into your head when you're in the shower. And it's just something that popped into my head when I was in the shower. So
okay.
It broke rule one, and then it just sort of, you know, and then we did actually run the process. We actually considered hundreds of other names. But by the time we got serious about it, we were like, well, okay, like we got to stop calling it because that was a joke name that popped into my head in the shower. Let's actually be rigorous about it. So we went through the process. But then at the end, was still the most good name. It was also the most bad name. But it was the most good name.
It still had the most upside.
Yeah. And so, yeah, we chose the one with the most upside, disregarding the downsides.
Very good. All right. So you went to Boston University. That's correct. Where you studied computer engineering?
Computer science. Yeah. Class of 2019.
Class of 2019.
That's right. Wow. Recent grad.
All right. Well, congratulations.
It took me 30 years to get my bachelor's degree. I enrolled in the computer science department in 1989. Got my degree 30 years later. So
yeah, you don't want to rush things.
No, exactly. Exactly. It's worth doing. It's worth taking your time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, so it's fair to say, I think that you're a math and numbers guy. Never had any formal management training. How did you transition from that into entrepreneur and CEO, Phil Libin?
So I started my first company. It was called Engine 5. It was in 1987. Started it with two college friends of mine. Geach and Brandon, and we were all engineers. It was originally going to be five of us. That's why we called it Engine 5, but then two people chickened out, so it was just three of us.
But the name stuck.
Yeah, the name stuck. And all three of us were engineers, and we were just working. We were just, you know, programming stuff. And I was the Geach and Brandon, my co-founders, are amazing engineers, and I was only like a relatively decent engineer. Mm-hmm. And so like I got to do all of the unimportant work, like, you know, figure out, you know, negotiate with customers and, you know, buy a suit jacket and, you know, go travel around. And so I just kind of became the CEO because like the other two people didn't want to do it. And plus they had like more important stuff to do. And it just kind of stuck. And like, so I kept expecting it. And you know, that was in 1997. So that was what, you know, 24 years ago. And just about every year since then, I always expect someone to like, tap me on the shoulder and be like, hey, wait a minute. Like, no one actually like agreed that you'd be the CEO. You just sort of fell into it. So I'm expecting to hear that any day now.
Fair enough. But it sounds like you were the most good option among your friends. So what did you learn about people, or what did you have to learn about people or people management, the business side of things too? Because, I mean, you have been quite successful at a number of different places.
I think moderately successful.
You're a humble guy.
You know, I think it is basically three jobs, three parts to being a CEO. There's always like, it's always the same three tasks. Like, and so there's only three things you have to do. You have to, you know, you have to control the vision. You have to make sure that there's the right people on the team to execute the vision. And you have to make sure there's enough money in the bank. And it's always these three things. Like, and the tactics that you use for these three things vary pretty widely depending on what stage of the company you're at, right? So like at the very beginning, when you're just like a tiny startup, then like the vision is the vision. You just invent something. But later, when you're, you know, a few hundred people, then you're not like inventing a new vision. You're just kind of keeping it on track. It's a different skill set. Mm-hmm. You know, the getting the right people in the beginning, it's just like, well, just hiring your friends. But pretty quickly, it has to grow past that. It has to be like, you know, by the time you're a few hundred people, it's got to be much more about like retaining people and developing people. And that's a totally different skill set. And then the money stuff, like at the beginning, you know, making sure there's enough money in the bank is all just jazz hands, right? It's like, it's raising money. At some point, you got to be a business, right? Like making sure there's money in the bank is about revenue and expenses, which is, again, a very different skill set from the jazz hands. So even though it's always like the same three things, what you do changes a lot. And so that's why I think there's it's extremely rare for the right, for the same person to be the ideal CEO at different levels of the company. Like the skill set for doing it from zero to 10 people is totally different than from, you know, 11 to 50. And it's totally different from, you know, 51 to a couple of hundred. And it's vastly different from that to, you know, thousands of people. And so you, when you get people like, you know, Jeff Bezos or, you know, Hiroshi Mikitani that like literally went from the first employee to being a CEO of, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of people, that is just rare. Shockingly rare.
Right.
Almost never happens. I'm certainly not like one of those people. So I definitely have like my sweet spot for where I'm a decent CEO. And then beyond that, I just, you know, I have no reason to think that I'd be particularly good at it.
What strategies or resources or maybe people, do you have any mentors that like kind of helped you? Like who'd you lean on when you needed a little guidance yourself?
I mean, there's a lot. And one of the things that I had to really, one of the things that's really improved my life, and it took a long time for me to figure this out, but one of the things that's really improved my life is like when I finally like figured out that I should ask for help, because I didn't used to very much. Like my personality was, I think a lot of people are just wired that way. You just kind of want to figure stuff out yourself. But like, as soon as I realized, man, that is really stupid. Like that approach to just like figuring it out myself is just super inefficient, because like there's already all these people that know the answer. Like, why am I like, what am I trying to prove by like taking extra time to figure it out myself and probably getting it wrong? I should just ask. So I think like that realization was pretty foundational. Mm-hmm. I'm really glad that I had that realization. And then ever since having it, it's actually been pretty straightforward. So I've been lucky enough to have many, you know, amazing mentors, because, you know, really accomplished people, what I found is almost, really 100% that I know, I'm sure there's some assholes out there that just don't know them, are actually quite generous with their time if you come with like decent questions. So if you like I've been able to get really good advice from tons of super well-known, super accomplished people just by like having well-formed questions in my head and asking them.
From a genuine place of interest, then I would assume.
Yeah. And like, and like obviously paying attention to the answer, and like, and people love that. Like, I like it. Like when people come to me for advice, like the most important thing is like, well, have you thought of any questions? Like, because if you haven't, then you're not looking for mentorship. You're looking for networking. That's kind of annoying. Right. Like I'm not a networking person. Nothing wrong with it. Lots of people are. I'm just not. Mm. But like, if there's like questions, if there's something we can like figure out together, that's different. And so, yes, I've had, you know, there's people like Esther Dyson, who was on my board at Evernote for a few years, that I learned a massive amount from, you know, Max Levchin at PayPal, Reid Hoffman, Jeff Bezos, that I've, you know, I've never worked with, but I've met him a few times in my life, and I came prepared with good questions, and he was super generous with, you know, with answers. So yeah, I think like advice and mentorship is available, I think, more widely than most people assume, if you just, you know, if you just seek it out and you're prepared to you're prepared for it.
Sure. I guess also if you show that you're putting in the work yourself, you're making an effort on your part to actually genuinely want to improve or find an answer, as opposed to just, yeah, connect or whatever, as it gets.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the, like the social climbing, the social networking aspect. Some people really thrive on that, and that's okay. Other people just like, it's kind of a turnoff. So like, I don't try to, you know, network and connect for the sake of networking and connecting. And I think these kinds of different groups of people, you know, naturally attract each other.
Yeah, fair enough. So I think it's fair to say, you mentioned Evernote, and I think it's fair to say that you're probably most well known for your work there, or at least just maybe the most
so
prominent.
So far,
of course. Mm-hmm, it's going to take over the world. This is set in stone, so it is written, so it shall be done. But Evernote, it was a company you co-founded. Well, did you co-found it, or you were just CEO? You were CEO, correct?
I co-founded it. So
you did co-found it as well.
Yeah, Evernote had a very unconventional start. So basically in 2007, we had just sold our second company, and we're sitting around trying to figure out what we wanted to do, decided to work on something around cognitive enhancement, just new definition of productivity, because smartphones were a new thing and we didn't really think that people were using them correctly. And then so started tinkering around on stuff, and then just in my research, I was introduced to this guy, Stepan Pachikov, who is this brilliant Russian-American, you know, inventor and entrepreneur. And he had started a company a few years earlier doing kind of a similar thing in California. We were in Boston. So I moved my team to California, and we decided to just merge the two companies. So we kind of combined two companies, and we started a new, you know, a new entity in 07. And so he had a company that was called Evernote with a capital N since like who knows when, mm-hmm. I think like 10 years earlier, working on like a whole history of like handwriting stuff and like, but the idea of like cognitive prosthesis of helping you remember stuff was something that he was very focused on with his team. I started working on separately, and then we kind of merged the two things. So I became the CEO, and we kind of had a new crop of co-founders. So there was a bunch of us. There was like, I think it was like 13 people right at the beginning of that. Oh, wow. So
you stayed on board there for about 8 years, correct? As CEO, and then another year on the board.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, something like that, like 9 or 10. I think it was maybe 9 years
somewhere around there.
A long time.
Yeah,
the longest
sure.
thing I've ever done, yeah.
I imagine with the time you started it, you did not think that that was in the cards.
Well, you know, I did actually. I kind of wanted to make it like when I, but this is the thing, like everything that I've started, well, maybe not the first couple of things, but certainly starting with Evernote, I really wanted it to be my life's work. I really thought, I don't want to do anything else. This is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And so I was talking about, how we wanted to make it a 100-year startup, how this was our life's work, and it was for people who had a life's work. Like our target audience for Evernote was people who grokked the idea of a life's work, who had something that they really wanted to pursue and they were passionate about, and it was going to take a long time, and Evernote would help them, would help them get there. So no, I very much expected and wanted it to be a very long term thing.
And that was a cognizant decision on your part to make it your life's work? Because I understand, like, in hindsight, looking back, like, that is my life's work or that's just my passion. But actually defining it as such seems to be very daunting to me.
Yeah, I mean, again, there's video of me probably from 2009, 2010 talking about it like that. So, yeah, no, this was a very, very early decision.
All right.
This is what we wanted.
And so you mentioned Evernote.
You got to remember, it was my third startup. So it's like I'd already like made and sold two smaller things. So like I think a lot of us were ready for it.
Yeah, fair enough.
Hey, let's not jump around. I'm not saying that everyone's first startup ought to be their life's work.
Yeah, and it's probably also like a topic that was, like you just said, something you were passionate about and had been working on in your quote-unquote spare time. So at its very basic form, it's reductive to say, obviously, but it's a note-taking app, a cognitive enhancement. What did you call it? A cognitive prosthesis?
Yeah.
A second brain?
Yeah.
That type of thing. You've been away from the company for about 5 years now. You got a little bit of...
5 or 6, yeah.
5 or 6 years. You have some...
And time has like no meaning anymore, right? Since the pandemic, it's like, I don't know.
All
this
just
was, like, last week,
together.
Was it 6 years ago? Yeah, I think it was 5 or 6 years. Yeah,
fair enough. But you might have a chance now with a little bit of hindsight, a little bit of distance to the project. What would you say like the biggest impact or influence was or is of Evernote?
You mean like on the world in general, or
generally speaking? Like, if you look back at it, like, okay, like this is like as a part of my life's work, this is like where it really helped advance. Second brain theory or helping people maximize their brain power. Where would you see it?
Yeah, I think in hindsight, the important stuff that we did, and I feel really, lucky and kind of proud to have been part of that team for so long, first thing is we made productivity as a category something that was cool and interesting again, because it hadn't been for 20 years before. Like basically like Microsoft Office came around and there was like a 30-year lull in like when no one really cared about productivity. And there was a lot of productivity hacking, mm-hmm. which was like around the edges. So there was lots of like little cults, like, getting things done and Lotus Notes and something mm-hmm. else. Like there was lots of like little pockets of things, but like a mainstream thing that just like captured the attention of normal people to say, hey, we can be more productive. We can be smarter. We can be better organized. Like that wasn't a thing. That wasn't a brand. We probably the best known productivity brand at the time, was Microsoft Office. But then as a lifestyle brand, there really wasn't anything. There was like there's something called like Franklin Covey, which sold like little, fake leather binders with like different paper inserts in malls and that kind of stuff.
I think I remember those.
And I think, I was a fan.
Trapper Keepers?
Yeah, the Trapper Keepers were great. Those are even older. Those are like back from the 80s.
Yeah, I'm an old dude.
Yeah, so I think we sort of said, hey, like there hasn't been a lot of innovation in this, but like everyone in the world needs it, and that I'm proud of that. you know, more tactically, I think we helped create, along with, you know, other a bunch of other companies, we helped create what smartphone, like, apps and ecosystem was going to be. You know, we were on the App Store. We were in the Apple App Store on day one. We were, you know, we were the first productivity app. Or at least we were there on day one. There's only, like, maybe there was, like, another one or two, but I kind of doubt it. And the idea that, like, PC software wasn't just, like, a smaller version, sorry, mobile software wasn't a smaller version of PC software, was, like, that was kind of a novel idea. And so, you know, I think it was Evernote and Uber and Dropbox and Airbnb. Like, we sort of, together, that cohort of companies that got started in 2007, 2008, 2009, like, we helped create the mobile world, which was pretty, you know, pretty high impact. And, you know, I think both of those we're still seeing the ripples from, right? Obviously, like, productivity is having another resurgence and another resurgence. There's a whole crop of newer companies that are doing, you know, really well that I think Evernote, you know, partially paved the way for. So, yeah, I'm thrilled that, you know, that I got to be a part of it. And the people, you know, that I worked with, that I met there, that I'd worked with before, are amazing. And it's amazing to see a bunch of them I'm still working with. So there's probably 20 people from the original Evernote crew that are kind of in our orbit at this point. Mm-hmm. And then there's a bunch of others that have just been amazing to see what they've gone on to do. So, you know, my CTO, Dave Engberg, was, you know, he was the CTO at Livongo and, you know, Teladoc. So that was, like, a, you know, big company that went public and then got merged with another big telemedicine company. And, like, he's helped change the world of telemedicine. My COO, Linda Kozlowski, is the CEO of Blue Apron. She's kind of the person who saved mm-hmm. Blue Apron. You know, Andrew Sinkov, who I've known literally, I think, since he was, like, 0 years old. But he was our head of marketing, and, you know, he's doing big things at Etsy. So it's just, I mean, the biggest impact in my personal life is just, like, seeing the diaspora flourish.
Okay. That feels really good. Now, you said there's about a 20, 30-year lull as far as productivity is concerned when, around the time when Microsoft Office came out. I can imagine that was an incredibly large hurdle to overcome for Evernote at first, just to kind of create the audience for it, or make the audience, the target group, aware that, yeah, this is something you can use and incorporate to support to change the way and influence the way you approach learning, to improve and enhance the way you recall information and use it. What were some of the strategies you used to drive growth, to get your message to the people, to your audience back then?
I mean, we didn't really... you know, we really focused on the product, and the product did a lot of its own, you know, growth and talking. And I think, you know, what the lesson I learned from that we've really tried to apply to everything we do at All Turtles is about the timing. Like, the for startups, like, your timing is kind of the most important thing. And I think the way to think about the timing is you pick an important problem, and that's hard, right? Because, like, so many startups start on things that aren't problems. Like, they just, like, invent something. It's not a problem that people have. So, like, find a thing that everyone you know actually does but doesn't like doing. So, like, an important problem. And then wait until the world changes so that a new solution to the problem becomes practical for the first time ever. And then execute like crazy. And that was kind of what we did, right? Like Evernote, the problem was very real. Like, no one liked Microsoft Office at the time. Like, everyone used it, but no one, I mean, I'm sure, sorry, I actually like Excel. There was very few people who were like, oh man, this is the best thing ever, especially, like, various productivity apps on their smartphones. But everyone, like, wanted and needed this kind of a thing. And yet there just hadn't been innovation in, you know, 20, 30 years. And then all of a sudden there were smartphones. And the promise of smartphones were like, well, we're going to have these really powerful computers that have full network access all the time on us all the time. And so what better way can we, like, stay organized and stay productive than really with a computer that always has access to the entirety of the world's information, because it's always connected to the internet and it's always with you. So you don't just have to do this for the 2 hours a day that you're sitting in front of your computer. You can be productive and you can have this capability all the time. And that was, you know, smartphones have been around for a few years, but they weren't going to be mainstream until the iPhone came out.
Sure. So it was a pretty easy sell then, just like, while you're using your phone every day anyway.
Yeah. Well, and like, we were the productivity app, yeah. You know, like every smartphone that shipped in the next few years, you know, we started on iPhone and then, you know, it was Android and BlackBerry and Chromebooks and everything else. Like, you know, they all shipped, they all came out with app stores and ecosystems. and they all needed to have, you know, they all needed to have like five apps, you know, like featured, pre-installed. And it was always like, it was always a web browser and an email client. So like everything had a web browser, everything had an email client. And then everything had like some social network, you know, Facebook or Twitter, or if you were in Asia, you know, maybe Line or something like that. And then there was some, like there was usually some kind of game. And then there was Evernote. And we were like, we were just in that like required five things in the fastest growing category at the time, which was smartphones. So our strategy was just like, was that. Our strategy was like, become a necessary app for
be
every
single
smartphone device that launches. And you know, and use the literally hundreds of millions of dollars of free marketing and advertising that we got from these platforms because, you know, they were interested in making the platforms and we were a very good platform player. So we invested a ton in the design and illustration. Like, you know, we spent, at one point we had $10,000 left in the bank. We decided we needed a new logo for Evernote. And so we had a friend of ours who was at Apple at the time, like, hey, can you make us a logo? We can't really afford to pay you anything like what you normally, you know, get paid. And because we don't have any, you know, very much money. And he's like, well, how much money do you have? And we're like, well, we have $10,000. He's like, all right, I'll make you a logo for $10,000. I was like, damn it. I should have said we only had $5,000. But yeah, we basically paid him our last money and he made the Evernote logo, which was like obviously the greatest $10,000 we ever spent because like it was so good that like it looked good next to other logos on the iPhone. And so Apple used it in all of their collateral. And they would like wrap the Moscone Center in like giant app icons. And we were always one of them. And there were like, there were, you know, subway, metro ads all over the world. And we were always on them because like it was a useful product in a useful category that was quickly growing. And we like took the effort to make, you know, the app icon look good and the design look good. So it just wasn't, you know, it wasn't ugly. And so like the marketing people of these platform companies liked it. And that was about it. I mean, that was kind of the focus. We didn't really do any growth hacking.
So it was a lot of timing, right place, right time, right product. A lot of parallels then with thinking.
Yeah,
about...
I think luck is a huge part of it. It sure. always is. And I think like the thing is just to, I think the skill is to, like you can't control when you get lucky by definition. And the skill is just to recognize when you've gotten lucky, like be aware of it and then do as much as possible to capitalize on that. So like we knew at Evernote that, you know, in 2008, 2009, we knew that we had just gotten really lucky with the timing. A bunch of bets we made paid off. You know, people ask like, because, you know, like iPhone wasn't obvious that it was going to be a big thing. Like a lot of analysts dismissed it in the beginning because they didn't have apps, you know, until over a year later.
Yeah, BlackBerry was the thing.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't have a keyboard. You couldn't cut and paste. And we made a big investment on it. Afterwards, people would ask me like, well, how did you know to like, how did you predict that like iPhone and smartphones were going to like take over the world? I'm like, I didn't predict anything. We placed a bet. Yeah. It's like we were at the roulette table and we placed a bet. And like, we didn't predict what the number was going to be. We just bet on it and we just bet right. And we could have bet wrong and then we would have been out of business and we wouldn't be having this conversation. So our bets paid off. And then when we knew that they had paid off, then we were like, okay, now is not the time to relax. Now is the time to execute and to do it at a higher level than we ourselves thought would be possible in all aspects, including the branding and the logo and obviously the product design and the customer support and all that stuff.
Sure. Preparation meeting opportunity, I think, is the best definition I've ever heard of luck. Like I was saying earlier, there's a lot of parallels, I think, between Evernote's kind of snowballing rise to prominence to success as there are in, now. So I would imagine that you probably don't have any dedicated growth strategies in place, but you are, you mentioned this earlier, running a blog, publishing content. I saw that you also have a think tank with like original research. You are publishing some of it's tongue in cheek. Some of it is probably things that you don't want to know. Like 1 in 10 of your colleagues, people are not wearing pants. Your video call.
1 in 10 that admit it. I mean, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot higher than that, people. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
But also that you gave a chat on Clubhouse, I believe earlier this month. Maybe that's a regular thing, a recurring thing. Clubhouse is a huge topic over here in Germany.
I haven't, you know, I think I've just done that one. I've only been on Clubhouse like maybe 3 times total. I'd be happy to do more, you know. I just replied. We don't like, I don't have a Clubhouse presence myself. Maybe I should, but you know, somebody invited me to give a talk, so it was my default to this kind of stuff is to, you know, say yes if it fits in the schedule, because sure. I kind of figure at some point, you know, like, I don't know if I'm like 9 minutes into my 15 minutes of fame or, you know, 14 and a half minutes, but, you know, sooner or later I'm going to wake up and no one's going to care about what I think about anything. And so until that happens, like if people are, you know, are kind enough to actually care about, you know, to ask my opinion about stuff, I'm just going to go ahead and
give it to
these
them.
Things.
Yeah. You're on Clubhouse, you're doing the blog, you got this other research stuff going on. Where are you trying to take mm-hmm from here? Do you have any concrete expansion plans? I did see that the website is in English and Japanese. I don't know if there's anything to read into that or if we can be expecting more languages to pop up in the future. Where's mm-hmm going?
Well, definitely be fully global. We're translating and localizing everything into, well, not even so much translating. We're creating original content, localizing the product, creating original content in lots of languages. So it'll certainly be in German, in Spanish, and Italian, and kind of all of the major European and Asian languages soon. Within, you know, I think there's stuff coming like every couple of weeks now. And so within a few months, we should be pretty global. We started with the English and Japanese just because we have a decent team in Japan. We've always, you know, back from the Evernote days, we've had a lot of a good presence in Japan because I just really love Japan and I miss traveling to there. But it's coming to everything. I really think that we're transforming. It kind of sounds trite to say, but I think we are. There's like a communication transformation that's happening in the world. Even bigger than that, like there's currently all of a sudden this year, there's a couple of hundred million people, a couple of hundred million workers right now in the world, probably 40 to 50 million in the US, you know, a few hundred million everywhere else, that for whom where they live and how they live can for the first time ever be disconnected from their job. That's never happened before at scale. Like in my entire life, where I live has always been completely about where the job is. I've never had an opportunity to go and like, you know, think about where I want to live. I was going to live near the office because I hate commuting. And for the first time ever, you know, a few hundred million people have an opportunity to totally disconnect those two things. And that is such a profound shift in the world. The ripples from that will affect everything, not just for those people, but for everyone in the world, for every single company on the planet. Video and distributed, like not assuming that people are in the same physical place all the time is going to be something that almost every aspect of life has to account for. A lot of video is going to pick up a lot of that slack, but it won't be just video. It'll be, you know, it'll be other things as well. We're helping to invent that. So I think the way that we communicate, the way that we share information, the way that we think about what has to be quote unquote live, versus, you know, asynchronous, what has to be in person versus on video. How do we blend those things seamlessly? So it's not like an either or, it's usually a both. We want to be a seat at the table for helping invent that world. I think we've got one. It's pretty cool. Again, this is one of these things where we didn't expect this. We got lucky. It was the right product and the right team at the right time. But now we've recognized how lucky we've gotten, and we're trying to you know, bend the world in a better direction because of it.
Well, it's sounds like you're on the right path there. So I wanted to ask you about this kind of common theme that kind of recurs in your work, and that's the use of visual aids. You mentioned we've been talking about Evernote, which is kind of a distilling of information, extrapolating of what's important and putting it into a more palatable form so you can kind of retrieve it. You mentioned the state machine earlier, this kind of video diagram thing that you have worked on. Where do you think your passion for that comes from, or why do you think you use those so often?
I was very introverted. I am still, you know, very introverted. I'm pretty shy. I was a really bad public speaker. I have, you know, I had a lot of anxiety about that, and I just didn't. You know, and not even like public settings, even among like, you know, like friend groups, like I was just very awkward. you know, I had to work intentionally to kind of overcome it. So for years, I was kind of a, you know, I would just kind of study, like, okay, well, how do normal humans like interact? I would like watch people and try to like learn like what they were doing that came naturally to them, but didn't come naturally to me. Like at one point in my 20s, I spent years like pretty deeply studying magic. Like I was like hanging out with a bunch of like magicians and like reading all about it and practicing. And I was like an amateur magician for a while because I sucked at it. But I was fascinated by the, you know, because magic is a very like intentional psychology where you're trying to do things that look natural, but obviously like every part of it has to be like planned, and keeping attention is a very specific thing. And so I've just been paying attention to that for a while, just as a coping mechanism, as a way to like make my way in the world. And I think it's made me, you know, it's made me observe a few things that I just realized are like, oh, actually a bunch of people could benefit from this. It's pretty effective. And, you know, how I try to remember things, how I organize things, how I try to communicate. And so, I've worked on a lot of things in my life. The ones that are the most fun are the ones that I'm making very much like for myself, like for people like me, because like I want to use them. Those aren't the most important things to make. I think there's a lot of people who are much more deserving of having their problems, you know, addressed than me. And so I've tried at All Turtles to work on all sorts of things that isn't for, you know, for us, it's for other communities. But once in a while you get a chance to work on something that's for, you know, for us, really twice in my life, once at Evernote and once at And yeah, those go quick. Those go so much faster, and they're a lot of fun. It kind of feels like cheating. So, yeah, I am making things that I want to use with people who also want to use them. That's the best job in the world.
Best job in the world is the job you wake up to and it doesn't feel like you're going to work.
Yeah, exactly. Like I'd be doing this regardless of whether or not Sequoia invested in us. So I'm glad they did.
But, yeah, sure. Yeah. It's a nice little cherry on top. I guess the last question, last topic I wanted to get to before I let you get out of here, sticking with the visual aids thing, another kind of visual medium you like to champion is this rock, paper, scissors concept visual aid for startups.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell me about that?
The rock, paper, scissors, you know, threat model of startup competition. It basically was like this. So, you know, people know rock, paper, scissors. Early startups are scissors. Recently successful startups that have some heft to them are rocks. And, you know, big companies are paper. And the competition, the threat model works the way that you expect. So if you're a brand new startup, you're a scissor, you're really fast. Your job is to, like, get in and out as quickly as possible, be really impressive. You are not threatened at all by paper, by big companies. They're just not fast enough. They're not your competition. Like, they're your targets. You can innovate so much faster. You can, like, cut away their customers, their employees. Like, you know, they're like, that's what you're doing. You don't care about other scissors. You should never care about what other new startups are doing, because, like, the chance of any individual startup succeeding is so small. Like, why worry about it? Worry about yourself because you're a scissor, and, you know, go and attack the big companies, or at least their market segments. They can't do anything against you. When startups that become unicorns, they become rocks. Like I think Evernote, you know, got to a point where we were clearly a rock. And the thing with rocks is, like, they're no longer threatened by the new startups because they're not big, slow companies yet. Like, they can still move pretty fast. And when they move with, you know, millions of users, millions of dollars. There's some, you know, some force there. So if you're running a rock and you see some new startup doing something cool, like, you can just buy them or copy them or whatever. But you can probably get there, you know, faster because you have many more resources. But you start getting threatened by paper. You start getting threatened by the big companies because you're going after the same customers, and they've got more lawyers, and they can undercut your pricing, and they can, like, tie you up and, you know, whatever. And of course, the flip side is, by the time you're a big company, you know, you're not so much threatened by the rocks because you can just buy them. Like, for large corporations, it's easier to write a check for a few $1 billion and just acquire a recently successful startup than
just overwhelm them,
you know, than to do anything else. So that's the model. And the main lesson from that for startup land is, the biggest mistake that many startups make and many startup investors make is, they start things in an area where there's a lot of rocks. And you don't want to do that. You want to start where there's no rocks. You want to start where there's only paper, like at Evernote. You want to start, like, when we started Evernote, there were no rocks. There were no, like, recently successful $1 billion productivity startups. There was a lot of paper. There was a lot of, like, giant companies who hadn't really innovated in 30 years. So those are the ideal conditions. The problem is that many founders and investors decide to make a startup specifically because someone has recently made a rock. Because someone goes, oh, man, like, those guys just made a car sharing company and now they're worth billions of dollars. Like, we should make a car sharing company. And be like, well, yeah, you should have 2 years ago.
Right.
Now you shouldn't everything. Because like now there's this rock, you know. Yeah, making a note-taking app was a good idea in 2007. It was a less good idea in 2010 because there was already, you know, us. So that's kind of the model. Like, look for things where there hasn't been much innovation. So when we started, yeah, it's like there's a bunch of scissors. There's a bunch of other like small video startups. I don't care. Just because like I don't have time to keep track of all that stuff. There were no rocks and there was a bunch of paper. There was a bunch of companies who just, you know, were big, but they hadn't really like done that much innovation over the past few years. So it was like an ideal time. And maybe it's still an ideal time, but we're, you know, sooner or later, there's going to be some rocks in the space. Hopefully we're going to be one of them. And then it won't be a great time to launch your new, you know, small video startup.
Right.
But we're going to have to start paying a lot more attention to what the big companies are doing.
Fair enough. Well, Phil Libben, thank you very much for joining me. Why don't you tell the people out there where they can find what you're doing?
Well, it's at mmm.app, mmm.app.
All right. Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me. All the best.
Thank you.
Take care.
Talk soon. Bye.
Bye.